You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for January 29th, 2016. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the WWF GOP Thunderdome Super Thursday Drag Race Soap Opera Survivor Spectacular. It's the Professional Left with Drip Glass and Blue Gal. Big Daddy Don Garlitz and Shirley Cha-Cha Muldowney.
Lord.
That's from the, a few people might recognize, Great Lakes Dragaway in Union Grove, Wisconsin, where the big ones ride.
You had to be there, folks.
It was a TV commercial for drag race, the drag strip. And it was hilarious. And it stuck with me for these many decades. But it's that kind of professional wrestling. You never know. The bushwhackers could show up. You don't know. Yeah. It could be crazy.
The drag racing and the bushwhacking and the... I love the bushwhackers back in the day. That was fun. They were funny.
I never got into professional wrestling. I liked amateur wrestling. I liked roller derby.
Yeah.
But something about roller derby, I just thought, you know, women...
Well, that's still going on. That's kind of become a feminist thing. Roller derby. Yeah.
But the idea of rigged, not fake, because they're actually...
No, it is. People get injured, but it's Japanese no drama is what right. It is.
It is staged.
It's staged to the point of having its finger on the pulse of America better than anything. If there was a, you know, news story where someone did something bad, all of a sudden you'd have a villain that represented that bad thing.
If the Belgians did something horrible this week, next week...
The Belgian will be coming into the ring and getting beaten up by, you know, whoever. Yeah.
Well, he'd win the first two rounds and then finally...
he'd win the two... And then the Hulk would Hulk out, right?
I apparently understand professional wrestling. And I do
totally
understand
do.
Public politics.
Yeah. They really get it. Yeah. They really understood, they'd have a banker, if there was some sort of bank scandal, they'd have some banker come into the ring. It just amazing. We have decided that there shall be no wagering at the Professional Left podcast, but we are taking bets that a year from now, Reince Priebus will be assistant managing a Cinnabons in Omaha right alongside Saul Goodman.
Yeah. Bye-bye, Reince.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, it's a thankless job. That job, no matter, and that's true for Debbie Wasserman Schultz, too.
Sure.
And leading a... First of all, it's a terrible mistake to have an actual office holder holding that job.
Yeah.
But also, and I don't know why she said yes to it. It's been terrible for her. But
Reince
really has no job. I mean, there is nothing for him to do now in the age of Citizens United. He has no power. So
he's one of those those little flippy arm display things out in front of used car lots. So he put the fan on to 12 feet tall, just flop around. That's what he does. Or he's the guy standing out in front of the H&R Block or the discount tax center in the Statue of Liberty outfit, flipping the sign around. I mean, he serves absolutely no purpose other than the fact, I suppose parties technically have to have a chairman because of the charter or something. So there has to be some illusion that this is not simply a corporation run by Fox News.
Well, and they collect all of the corporate sponsorships for their conventions. I mean, their staff has to organize that. And that is on, I hate to say both sides, but on both sides, big money from AT&T and on the Democrat side and Home Depot on the Republican side, fund these events. So,
well, the Republican, whatever the hell it is tonight, is sponsored, I believe, by Google.
Oh, my God.
So, there's branding. They make a shit ton of money off of these things. They're TV shows. They're spectacles.
Yep.
And what is more spectacle-y than Hulk Hogan saying, no, I'm not going to step in the ring with this son of a bitch. What are you going to do now? There's no show without me. And that's it. I am not amazed by Donald Trump's grasp of how TV works.
Mm-hmm.
I'm amazed at how other people do not understand how television works, how what politics on the right has turned into and why it is the way it is. It has caught, speaking of useless figureheads who have no actual job other than flopping around in the wind, it has caught the entire Beltway reasonable conservative pundit caucus completely flat-footed.
They're
not dumb people. David Frum is not stupid, and Michael Gerson is not stupid. David Brooks isn't stupid, and so forth. But it has trapped them in this really got to be horrible place. Fortunately, there's lots of money involved, so they can be comfortable.
They can sleep on a bed of money and feel all right.
They sleep on a much more comfortable mattress than I do when it comes to money. But in terms of facing yourself in the mirror, they're trapped. There's no fiction that they can concoct that can explain the bullshit that's happening right in front of them.
Well, the only way to get through that and the only pathway out is a big door called denial.
Yeah, exactly.
You've been talking a lot about that this week on your blog.
Yeah.
And I loved how Charlie Pierce said the most memorable moment of the week for me, apart from the 77-year-old white man NAACP chairman saying nice tits
you'll have to give that a fuller explanation.
The head of the NAACP of Maricopa County is a 77-year-old white guy.
Yeah.
And apparently, I've seen pictures of these high school girls who were wearing T-shirts that said N-I-star-star-G-G-R.
N-I-star-star-E-R.
For the N-word. And their shirts spelled out the N-word but had asterisks for the G. Because they got photographed doing this as a joke. And so a reporter asked the head of the NAACP of Maricopa County, who is a 77-year-old white guy, what he thought of this. And in the course of the interview, he told the reporter that she had nice tits. Nice tits! And
look, honey.
And no, wait. It gets one more thing. Then he had to apologize. Now, of course he said, I'm sorry if anyone was offended.
What, she didn't have nice tits?
And then he said, I'm really fucking sorry.
I like this guy. Because, hey, she had nice... Yeah, sure, I can still do the black thing. But
And the Twitter, on the Twitter, he said he had a tweet with Joe Arpaio. Joe Arpaio, @RealSheriffJoe. Longtime friend John Harris came by my office. He's the new local head of the local NAACP. I expect a great relationship.
Yeah, I have a feeling NAACP doesn't mean that.
in Maricopa County.
Well, I'm sure there's a story behind how a 74-year-old...
white guy, personal friend of Joe Arpaio's got to be head of the local NAACP. Yeah.
I can't find it in my heart to say, well, you know, that's the worst thing I've heard in a month. No.
I'm really fucking sorry. I didn't mean to be mean to you. I apologize if anyone was offended. I could have said nothing. Oh, he said, I could have said nothing. It was a compliment.
I was raised to compliment the ladies. Now you're telling me that political correctness is ruining this country. Okay. That's fine. So this is what you get for trying to help the colored people. Mic drop. Old white guy out.
You're listening to the Professional Left Podcast, professionalleft.blogspot.com.
The most memorable moment of the week for me was Charlie Pierce saying, I don't know what conservatism is anymore.
Yeah.
It's a bunch of adjectives by the side of the road. It is absolutely meaningless. All right, so you do have a definition for conservatism.
Yeah, because conservatism doesn't mean anything. From a philosophical or ideological point of view. It hasn't for decades, if it ever did. There is no true American conservative movement, and there really never has been. There are people who use the label of conservative to gather people under their banner. But what I tried to do was to ask a much simpler question, a utilitarian question. What are the characteristics that virtually all American conservatives, from Rush Limbaugh to David Brooks, what do they all have in common? Because once you've eliminated all the fancy language and the BS about philosophy and tax policy and everything else, if you can boil it down to shared characteristics, you can come up with a pretty decent utilitarian definition of what conservatism really means. It really truly is. And once you understand that, you can start predicting what they will do and understand why they do what they do. So I've come up with four characteristics that are sort of interlocking. The first is that American conservatism is an ideological and political system which believes that liberals are the most dangerous existential threat to America, period.
Mm-hmm.
If you're on the left, wherever the left is this week, if you're on the left, you are the threat. You must be contained at any moment. Therefore, it's a system that also believes that any Democratic president who tries to govern as a Democrat is, by definition, illegitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore must and should be obstructed and destroyed at any cost. That's the reaction to the action. If liberals are the most dangerous existential threat to America, then they must be opposed at any and all turns, especially at the presidential level.
And also to the extent that you will even perform fraud.
Oh, yeah.
Get at them.
Everything is permitted.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing that gets me is when you're so sure of your rightness and their wrongness.
Yeah.
That you can perpetuate fraud against Planned Parenthood, and that's okay. And people excuse that. Turns out the grand jury didn't, but well, that's an inconvenience.
what's the Corinthians quote about love forgives all, bears all?
Yep.
You know, conservatism forgives all, bears all.
As long as you're in the tribe.
As long as you're in the tribe, everything is permitted. Fraud is permitted. Impeachment is permitted. Yep. Obstruction is permitted. Shutting the government down is permitted. Getting people killed is permitted. It doesn't matter because you're at war. You're in a deep existential twilight struggle for the soul of America. And your enemy is the left and you must defeat them. Therefore, whatever you have to do, if you have to gin up an impeachment trial against a sitting Democratic president who's, you know, in the middle of prosperity and peace, do it. And never be ashamed of the fact that the next president is named Bush. Is one who you absolutely reverse every single thing you said you believed under Clinton. Mm-hmm. Every single thing they said they believed when Clinton was president, Republicans completely reversed the minute George Bush became president, and then re-reversed the minute the Black Kenyan became president. And all that is okay because they're the bad guys. And so any means necessary is acceptable. Now, to make this work, the third characteristic is you depend on your ideological and political cohesion on massive, ongoing, self-reinforcing regime of historical revisionism and doublethink. You have to constantly lie about the past, and you have to constantly lie about your lies about the past. You have to invent fake history. You have to remember that Vince Foster really did kill, or that Clinton really did kill Vince Foster. You have to remember that Bill Clinton really was a rapist, that George Bush really was a great president, or maybe he wasn't. Ronald Reagan never raised taxes. And you have to have a completely delusional understanding of your own past. You have to be in complete denial all the time about everything that's happened before today, because otherwise it all falls apart. Otherwise somebody starts saying, well, wait a minute, here's where you said you hate deficits and they must be opposed at all costs. Here's where you said, fuck deficits. Who cares about deficits? Deficits don't matter. How do you reconcile those two? And the answer is they don't. Their brains are not wired that way anymore. So that's because the fourth characteristic is for ideological and political cohesion. You're in the constant state of ideological purification. Anyone who disagrees with you to any degree is either obviously stupid or secretly in league with the liberals.
Yeah.
And therefore, you don't have to listen to them. So anybody who tells you anything that contradicts what you believe must be a liberal. And therefore, rule number one applies. Oh, they're part of the dangerous liberal conspiracy. Out they go. And that's how they have purged out anybody who stepped one fucking inch off the reservation. Boom, gone. They're a rhino. They're a squish. They're not. They're a centrist. They love Barack Obama. They're part of David Brooks voted for him because he had a crease in his pants. How many different times have you heard that over and over again? Because these are mental children, and all they remember are the playground insults of 4-year-olds. That's how their brains.
Speaking of 4-year-olds, Ron Fournier, I want you to get into this. What happened with have we climbed another peak in our search for peak Fournier?
We really have. We really have. So my thesis is any conservative from David Brooks to Rush Limbaugh to David Frum to Mark Levin is in this universe. They might hate each other, but every one of them contends that everyone else who isn't like them is not a real conservative. And every one of them lies about the past constantly, lies about their past, lies about their party's past, lies about what happened yesterday. And so all of them are by definition, if you take these four characteristics and put them together, that's what a conservative is. And you can predict what they do if you use those four simple definitions. Peak Fournier. Oh, my God. Ron Fournier, who has made a living by plopping himself into seats, by being placed in chairs around tables on Sunday morning television shows and saying both sides. That's all he does. That literally is all he does. He has no qualification for being anywhere other than a Wendy's asking me if I want, you know, fries with that. The fact that he is really, really reliable doing this one thing, sitting his ass in front of a microphone in a chair, and anything that happens, it's both sides. And we reached peak Fournier because the Flint, Michigan water crisis, in which Governor Snyder decided to poison his own citizens for profit and then ignored the evidence that he was in the process of poisoning his own citizens because, fuck it, who are they? They're poor. Why bother listening to them? And Ron Fournier, who is from Detroit and who just finished a knob-polishing, glossy, very complimentary interview and story about Governor Snyder, just as this was breaking, concluded that, you know who's really responsible, Blue Gal? You know who really is responsible?
Who's really responsible?
Sure, Governor Snyder, but also Barack Obama. You know, the EPA and Barack Obama are really equally responsible.
You mean the EPA that the entire Republican Party wants to eliminate?
Yeah, yes.
That one?
And Barack Obama. And it went so far that, I mentioned this on the last podcast, Ron Fournier pasted pictures of George Bush flying over Katrina, flying over New Orleans, and a completely fake picture, a real picture of Barack Obama flying over Australia. And it's been a week since this has happened, and he hasn't backed off from it. He's gotten an ally, though, Matthew Dowd.
Oh, Lord.
Matthew Dowd, who also has a job sitting like a turd at a table saying both sides, both sides, both sides. Who is best known as the person who ran George Bush's reelection campaign in 2004, and is second best known as saying every day since that, I'm an independent. I'm not a Republican or a Democrat anymore. I'm an independent. No, you're a fucking Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And you're hiding out. You're doing what every conservative, you're doing what conservatives do. You're lying about your past. You're lying about your past, and you're pointing fingers at everyone else and saying, they're not the real ones. I'm the real one. They're not the real ones, which makes you a conservative. But all the criticism that came after Ron Fournier over his lies on Twitter, all of them were greeted with sort of partisan hand. And Matthew Dowd just says they can all rot in their partisan graves as far as I know.
Oh, man.
You know, there's all these partisans.
Maybe you'd like to rot in some Flint drinking water. That's what I'd like you to do.
The thing that always gets overlooked, and the thing that I'm tired of beating into the ground, but I will do it one more time, is that centrism, both siderism, making a fetish out of it, is every bit as partisan as being Rush Limbaugh. The point I was trying to make, and the point I make probably to the point of tedium, is that both siderism and centrism and everyone is to blame equally every time there's a Republican travesty is just as ritualized and fetishized form of partisanship, blind, ignorant, not ignorant, blind, deliberate, lying partisanship as Rush Limbaugh. Because if every time you have a Republican atrocity and you greet it with, well, you know, if only Barack Obama were a better leader, if only both sides could get along, you are just as big a fucking liar as Mark Levin or Rush Limbaugh. Except you come at your lies from this voice from nowhere.
And you're actually worse because in addition to lying, you're covering up for the lies
you're on the
right. So you're a double liar.
What Rick Perlstein said, you are structurally advantaging people who lie for a living because you're saying to them, you can get away with it because I'll cover your ass because I'll blame the liberals too. And then when it comes to election time, we can all just say, well, isn't it a shame how everyone's bad? I guess I'll vote for Republicans because everybody sucks. You know, everybody's the same. And it is long past time, honest to God, that people like Fournier were fucking fired, were confronted on the street, not with any hostility or physical.
They can have a blog on Blogspot, though.
But you see
like
him,
we do.
You see him walking down the street carrying his coffee. Please feel free to walk up to him and call him a lying sack of shit.
Yep.
And make sure he understands that people do read him, and people outside of his weird little fetish both-siders tribe read him. And we're onto his bullshit, and we know he's a hack. And again, the question for me this week was not, isn't David Brooks a liar? Yes, he is. Isn't Ron Fournier? But imagine, cast your mind wide, and imagine how big the conspiracy has to be.
To protect these guys and make sure they always have a job.
And make sure they nobody ever pushes them on anything. Make sure that Mark
Shields never pay a price for being wrong.
Mark Shields never asked David Brooks, well, didn't you just say the opposite last week? I mean, I'm sitting here for the last 20 years talking to you, and you're full of shit every week, but didn't last week you say the exact opposite? And EJ Dionne, you never, ever, EJ Dionne, you're such a pussy. Pardon my language, but you're such a complete spineless douchebag. You never, ever stand up to these people. And that's, and this is why I have.
Well, he's just as dependent on his paycheck as anybody else. So, you know, and their paycheck says don't cross David Brooks ever. Yeah.
And so my question is always follow the money.
Yep.
Follow the money. Who is it at the top of the food chain who is sitting there every day saying, damn, that David Brooks, he's so wise. Who's blowing in a call to Andy Rosenthal, I think, who's the editorial page director, say, David Brooks is doing a good job. Make sure you pat him on the back. No, he's doing a great job. Who is that person?
Yeah.
Who are
we know who those people are. They're Upper East Side millionaires, billionaires.
Yeah. Who want to believe, who want to
have that.
They want to believe.
They don't want to believe that their party is the party of Rush Limbaugh. They're better than that. You know, Driftglass, there was a Democratic town hall this week.
Yes, there was.
And as Wonkette said, they covered the really important issues, which are, number one, Bernie is a dirty communist.
Dirty, dirty commie, yep.
Two, Hillary does war Ghazi with Wall Street on her emails.
Yes.
And three, Martin O'Malley does not exist. So
he's a leprechaun. You know that Martin O'Malley's a leprechaun. You're never going to get big old. No.
But Bernie Sanders did make a really good point about Social Security and needing to raise the cap on Social Security taxes. I wrote a post about this. I don't want to go all Bob Seska on you. I wrote a post over at Crooks and Liars. I love it when Bob does that. He always talks about something he wrote, which is great.
Well,
but
when you spend half your time in front of a keyboard researching and writing, it's hard not to say.
Not to start talking about your writing. And I'm back to writing again, which is fun. I am enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
It's stressful sometimes, but I'm really enjoying getting back to writing, which is fun. But Bernie Sanders did talk about raising the cap on Social Security, and I really want to emphasize, we often try on this show to give people vocabulary on how to talk about issues. You know, Joe Scarborough is done paying his Social Security taxes for the year. It's January 28th.
Right.
He was finished over a week ago.
Yep, done.
Done. Tom Friedman finished 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
For the year. Yeah, he's done.
New Year's Day, he was done.
Done. Once you've made $118,500,
you're done
for the year paying Social Security tax. And so you get a raise. You get that Social Security raise in your paycheck because they don't take taxes out after you've earned the first $118,500.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want people to understand that and frame it as, you know, most people pay payroll taxes 52 weeks out of the year. They don't get a break.
Yes, they do.
It's the millionaires who get a break. It's people that make, and I figured it out, if you make exactly $1 million a year, if that's your paycheck,
uh-huh.
6 weeks, that's how long it takes you to pay your Social Security taxes. 6 weeks. Most of us pay payroll taxes 52 weeks out of the year.
Yes,
so I want people to be able to frame it that way. Most people can understand payroll taxes, get it taken out of your paycheck. It's every week. It's through the end of the year. And understand that there are... the rich people in this country get a big, huge break from that,
mm-hmm.
and there's no need for it. I know that the justification for that at one time was, wealthy people, you know, there is a cap on benefits as well, so we want wealthy people to buy into Social Security, even though they might not really need it.
Right.
We want them to buy into it, so we cap their earnings and cap their taxation, but we have such wealth inequality in this country right now that there's no point. This is pointless. And if anyone wants to talk about Social Security being in crisis, there is one very easy solution to ending that quote-unquote crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And if all of a sudden you realize that's the only answer, raising the cap or eliminating the cap on Social Security taxes is the only answer that we will accept, all of a sudden it's not a crisis anymore.
Right.
It's really interesting how all of a sudden, no, Social Security tax sounds okay.
Yeah, no, it's fine. It'll be fine.
So,
we'll figure it out. Yeah, no.
So, you know, frame it that way. It's important to frame it that way. I also wanted to talk for a minute about a post that was at, I believe it was Tumblr. It might have been Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
But it really meant a lot to me. It's about white privilege. And it's important that I think, as a lot of people have been talking about in the media, smart people have been talking about. White people talk about white privilege. I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm.
This person, Samher Alhato, posted to wherever, whatever platform he posted to, and he said, when black folks have several children, they're called irresponsible. When white people have several children, it's called 19 kids and counting. When Muslims are accosted for having the ability to marry more than one wife, they're called misogynistic. When white people do it, it's called sister wives.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also argue that arranged marriages, it's called the bachelor, you know, and mm-hmm. multiple women, one man choosing from a harem is, you know, is also that. When various cultures of brown folks around the world have arranged marriages, they are shamed for it. When white people do it, it's called the show Married at First Sight.
Yeah.
Do you want to know what white privilege is? Watch TLC.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to bring that up. I think that's marvelous. And there are all kinds of places where white privilege hides, and we need to expose it. And that's a start.
Well, white privilege is when something becomes a crisis.
When heroin becomes a crisis in your white neighborhood, all of a sudden Congress pays attention.
It's when your neighbor's kids,
yep.
you know, your friends,
your brother. Grandchild. Mm-hmm. Yep. And when your grandchild is gay, mm-hmm.
then
we're willing to talk about it. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are all kinds of ways in which this unfolds. And clean drinking water is another one that we really need to understand, that it is Governor Snyder who stopped revenue sharing between communities mm-hmm. in Michigan. Governor Snyder did that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, places where there was, to which there was white flight, took their taxes with them and kept them.
Mm-hmm.
And communities of color, like Flint, lost those tax revenues and suffered. And this was definitely, this whole water crisis is a racial issue. And I'm so glad the mayor is taking this on and being incredibly strong and not mincing words. And she, the other day, was willing to back out of a press conference and not appear at a press conference with the governor if he didn't play ball with her the way she wanted to. And she got $3 million out of him. To talk about how we're not going to pay for this sludge that's coming out of our faucets.
Mm-hmm.
And the atrocious ballsiness of demanding payment for water that is poisoning our kids. I mean, that's just horrible. So she will not play ball with someone who does not do the right thing. So I'm very proud of her.
Well, and go to any large city that, mm-hmm. you know, the people who are unfriendly and are prone to being bigoted assholes will point to and say, see, this is what happens when those people run a city.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you will find 9 times out of 10, a former industrial manufacturing hub
mm-hmm.
where there used to be really good blue collar and white collar jobs, really good manufacturing jobs. There used to be a thriving middle class. There used to be a thriving working class. And there used to be neighborhoods that were bustling. And there used to be, go to the south side of Chicago, go to 75th Street. You will see what used to be, and still is, but used to be the black middle class.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then extract from those neighborhoods the jobs, drain away the businesses. Take away all of the industry, take away all the businesses, turn the unemployment rate from high to obscene for a generation, and watch what happens.
And defund the schools.
And defund the schools and make sure that anybody who can afford to gets the hell out of there. Leave behind the people who are least able, who are least capable of adapting to massive economic and geographic change, and just abandon them. Abandon them, abandon their kids. You've extracted all the value you can from their labor, so you're going to book out.
Make sure that zoning allows for plenty of payday loans, liquor stores, and gun dealers.
And this, again, this was not a crisis until, really, I would argue, the housing market collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
This was not a crisis as long as people could continue to pretend they had a middle-class lifestyle by taking out equity in their homes,
mm-hmm.
by moving into service sector and technology jobs.
Yep.
And
as soon as the banks started to collapse,
uh-huh.
the cover of Newsweek said, we're all socialists now.
Yep. And suddenly, It stopped
suddenly,
being
we
those
need a
people.
Bailout.
It's yeah. not exactly. It's not being those people who were lazy and shiftless, literally shiftless, because you don't have a shift. You're not working a shift at the factory. That's where that word comes from, I believe. So it's suddenly it's no longer those people. It's holy crap! It's the entire middle class. Now it's a crisis.
Mm-hmm. Now that is what white privilege is.
Exactly, exactly. And there are certain messengers and gatekeepers of white privilege, and a lot of them work in the New York Times and the Washington Post. And they decide what is important and what is not, and what's a crisis and what is not, and who is valuable and who is not. This week, I'll go back to the David Brooks well one more time, just to point out that this week, Mr. Brooks is in full-on freak-out panic mode over Donald Trump and Ted Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
But he wrote a column, and I don't have it in front of me, but in which he lumps together, this is 800 word column, mind you, he lumps together Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, and Bernie Sanders as unelectable extremist nuts 8 different times in one column. Because, and it's an unpaid ad for Marco Rubio, because he's sure that eventually Marco Rubio will come to the fore, and he'll realize that he has to provide an optimistic message, and he's the guy. He'll be the guy. Don't worry. Don't you worry. He'll be the guy. Said
he's dumb as toast, Driftglass.
I'm sorry. Well, he's manipulative.
I'm sure he loves his kids. I'm sure he's a nice guy to play golf with. I'm not denigrating his humanity. I'm saying he's just not bright.
He will shut up and do what David Brooks tells him to do.
He will shut up and do what the Koch brothers tell him to,
exactly,
too.
Exactly. And so that makes him the ideal candidate, the ideal establishment candidate. He will shut up and do what he's told. But it is a measure of the degree to which the privilege of declaring someone to be outside the norm. This is why liberals are never allowed on television. We're all outside fringe nuts. We happen to be right about a lot of things. We go to church. We have jobs. We're just like any other normal American. We just happen to believe in a certain way the country should be run that's different and makes people who own newspapers or the people who are the front men for those who own newspapers and magazines and televisions and radio don't want to hear about. They do not want our vision of this country to be discussed, much less enacted, but they don't even want to talk about it. So that's why you never allow liberals on television. You never allow them on radio. You never allow them at the table. And you always put in a Ron Fournier or a Harold Ford Jr. instead of an actual fucking liberal. And
yep. Hey, Driftglass.
Yes?
We have to leave a space here because we don't know if we're going to cover tonight's debate with the Republican Party minus Donald Trump, whether we're going to cover that on this podcast or wait till next week. But you'll know when you hear the podcast what we decided to do. It won't be a mystery.
I need to leave right now to stock up at the liquor store.
Okay.
There's not enough liquor on this block right now to
get through tonight. Yes. We're recording on Thursday. We love you guys. And just so you know, we are going to cover whatever happens when it happens. We just do it once a week. Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Matilda. Matilda is sitting in a box of yarn, and there's nothing more to say about that. She's in the club. That's it.
Period.
Period. You're in a box of yarn. You belong. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service Go Postal Unions letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us. And don't forget our Amazon link at our website. We believe in buying local, but we also believe in shopping Amazon with our link if your alternative is a big box store. Just so you know, there are some book recommendations coming up in Science Fiction University that you might want to put on your wish list or put on your notification list that are coming out this year that look pretty good. So we believe in shopping Amazon if you're not going to go to a local bookstore and buy books. Approximately 1% of our listeners support this podcast with an actual contribution. Thank you so much for doing that. You're awesome. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't done that yet, see our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details. Both our PayPal and postal address information is there at professionalleft.blogspot.com. We've had a couple listeners write in and ask us, have you gotten your tickets for Netroots Nation yet? Not yet. We have hotel reservations. but we have not gotten our Netroots Nation tickets yet, and we're kind of waiting for the tax return money to come before we do that.
What panel will be serving on? We don't know.
We don't know if we're going to be invited to be on a panel. We're not organizing a panel, but if you know some podcaster that needs a couple podcasters for the panel, let us know. We'd love to help them out, and we're just looking forward to being there and seeing everybody that can come. It's in St. Louis. It's in the summer. It's actually over my birthday. It's over the weekend, July 16th, which is my 53rd birthday. So
yay,
there will be cake.
Right. Hey, can I exercise a bit of privilege here?
Okay.
In honor of Neil deGrasse Tyson's mic drop.
Yes.
On the Flat Earth Society, the Flat Earth debate.
Yes.
I'd like to mention, since it is also the Challenger disaster's 30th anniversary today.
Yeah.
Another mic drop by another physicist named Richard Feynman.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Everyone knows what happened with the Challenger. Richard Feynman, if you don't know, you can go over to my blog and you can check out I did a reprint of something I wrote a long time ago. But Richard Feynman is the guy, the physics genius, who's also a really good teacher and could explain things really well. And while NASA was trying to bullshit its way out of this disaster and bring in lots of people in white coats and pretend that nobody could have predicted what had happened. I mean, it's a complete mystery. And here's a bunch of charts and graphs. And ooh, look, it's very complicated. Everybody should go away now. Richard Feynman, live on camera, took a C-clamp, a glass of water, and a chunk of the O-ring. And
he put it in ice water.
Dropped the O-ring in ice water and pulled out and said, look, this is what happens to gaskets when it's freezing outside. Period. That was the best freaking science mic drop I've ever seen in my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys in the white coats ran away because somebody, and that's the gift of clear explanation. And that's the nature of science. You can cut through so much bullshit if you just speak clearly, think clearly, and are willing to go where the facts take you. And so a big tip of the hat to Richard Feynman, without whom the Challenger disaster might have been just this inexplicable act of God that nobody knows how it happened, as opposed to a political act, a political decision to launch a spacecraft under unsafe conditions in the face of engineers who told you not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want that to be lost in the 30-year remembrance of that tragedy.
No. And we have science deniers all over the place now, and it really is important. You know, the opposite of that is a U.S. senator bringing a snowball to the floor of the Senate.
Yeah. I'd love to pair those videos. That would be awesome.
That would be really good. Please rate our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and thank you for doing that. So, Drift Class, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Well, Gal, the Internet Kitties wonder how long before the GOP Congress blames Barack Obama for faking the Planned Parenthood videos.
Let's think about living.
Think about living.
Just think about loving.
Think about loving.
Just think about the hooping and the hopping and the popping and the loving, loving, loving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast. Recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2016, Drift Class Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome! Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Drift Class.
Science Fiction University Dogfaced Herman writes and says that he just came in from cleaning the horse stalls. One of his girls, Tequila, managed to get a single turd on top of a bag of shavings that was in her stall. And it made him think of the Twilight Zone episode, A Penny for Your Thoughts. Do you remember that one, Derfus?
I do.
The coin lands on its edge and gives him telepathic powers for the day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still not as bad, Dogfaced Herman says, as when Tequila pooped in her water bucket. That was the worst version of bobbing for apples ever. I was going to add pictures of this, and then I thought better of it. Thank you, Dogfaced Herman. We don't need visuals on that one.
No, but horses are fun. Horses give you my uncle had horses for years and years, and I visited his ranch many, many times. And horses are fun, but they're a whole different set of problems than cleaning out cat boxes.
Yes. I had a stepson. He passed away many years ago who had severe cerebral palsy, and horse therapy was very important for those kids. And the people that worked with kids with disabilities and horses together were very special people. I enjoyed that very much. And he did too. My stepson really enjoyed riding those horses. He couldn't walk, but he could ride a horse.
Yeah. Actually, me and middle child had a conversation about horses today. And me and junior dude and middle child talked about horses today and owning horses in a city. Would it be possible to own a horse in a city? Could we get to school on horseback? Where do we put our horses? And I couldn't tell them whether it was illegal or not to own and operate a horse within a city, or just was a really bad idea. That
it just depends on the city code and where you live, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure. But all right, well, let's get to the Science Fiction University quiz.
All right.
This is one of Dogface Sherman's favorite science fiction topics. How do we humans organize ourselves?
Badly.
Into governments and so forth.
Okay. Generally speaking, not very well.
All right. Well, let's sloppily. Try this out. Here is clip number one.
Bull-run Barter Town.
You know who.
Say.
Master Blaster.
Say loud.
Master Blaster.
Master Blaster. What?
Master Blaster runs Bartertown.
Louder.
Master Blaster runs Bartertown.
Lift embargo.
Yeah, okay. We organize ourselves in a circle around Tina Turner.
Yeah.
Clearly the right thing to do. We organize ourselves in the post-apocalypse into brutal, laissez-faire, capitalist hellholes where the market controls everything. And
the movie is?
Beyond Thunderdome, Mad Max.
Beyond Thunderdome, exactly. Whoever controls the spice pig shit controls Bartertown, and that's all that matters. All right, let's try this one.
Okay.
Number two.
I'm told you've had counsel and been given orientation, Mr. Wordsworth, but I'm still not sure in my own mind that you understand the purpose of this hearing. The field investigators in your sector have classified you as obsolete. This finding carries with it serious implications. Do you understand that, Mr. Wordsworth? Now, I ask you again, your occupation?
I am a librarian, sir. That is my occupation. That is my profession. If you people choose to call that obsolete...
Request clarification of the term?
Yes, the term, Mr. Wordsworth, you people, you make reference to the state?
I make reference to the state.
And you persist in declaring your occupation as being that of a librarian. Is that correct?
That is correct, sir.
A librarian. Having to do... with books.
Yes, sir. Books.
Oh, well, those are the voices of two Twilight Zone veterans. One of them is Burgess Meredith, and the other one, I swear, is Fritz something or other, who always plays a snotty businessman or a Nazi or something. I think it's unfair, but he was a good character actor. So I assume this is a Twilight Zone episode, and I assume it's the one where Burgess Meredith is useless.
That's right.
And useless people are not tolerated.
That is correct. And Fritz Weaver.
Fritz Weaver. Ah, that's right.
Fritz Weaver and Burgess Meredith, and it is about a librarian being declared obsolete and sentenced to death. Yes.
Fritz Weaver doesn't sound right unless he's wearing a monocle.
Yep, there you go.
But a wonderful show. Always recommend Twilight Zone.
All right, number three.
The officer on my left, who's in charge of our medical unit, is M18. In due course, you will each be given one of the initial letters indicating your department and range of duties and your individual numbers. I must warn you that any use of surface given names, surnames, and former military rank will be regarded as a serious breach of the discipline which is essential to our purpose. This purpose I can now reveal to you. We are here beyond the reach of the enemy, to provide the supreme retaliatory force which can, if necessary, absolutely annihilate all opposing enemy forces once and for all. From here we can attack without being attacked. The world above, we are invisible. But its destiny is in our hands.
Oh, all right. British.
Yep.
Numbers, underground, Cold War. I'm going to go with the generic Doctor Who, but that can't be right.
It's not Doctor Who. It is BBC. It is from a series called Out of the Unknown, which actually filmed science fiction stories in a series. And the story that is being filmed, or that is in the clip, is a book called Level 7, which was by an American author, Mordecai Rochwald, from 1959, in which a first-person narrative of modern soldier X-127 lives underground and pushes the button that launches nuclear weapons. And this book narrates life within a deep underground shelter before, during, and after a nuclear war. So it's Cold War, as you said, deep, deep residence beneath the earth, bombs, stuff like that.
Yeah, post-apocalyptic. Apparently, most governments have to crop up after something bad happens.
That's right. But the military creates this society, and it doesn't go well. So there you go. All right, number four.
We've just received warning from the Office of the Handicapper General that suspected anarchist Harrison Bergeron has escaped from custody. Arrested 6 years ago for propagandist vandalism, broadcast piracy, refusal to report for his quarterly handicapping evaluations, and for the blatant removal of his handicaps in a public place, Mr. Bergeron had been awaiting trial in a maximum security prison here in Washington, D.C., when he miraculously disappeared from his cell earlier this evening. Please be advised that Bergeron is a genius and an athlete, is under-handicapped, and is considered to be extremely dangerous. If you see this man, please contact your local authorities immediately.
Oh, I love this story. Yeah. I remember reading this one in junior high, I think. This is Harrison Bergeron, a wonderful story about enforced equality, enforced sameness. Everyone has to be dumbed down to the same level by law. And our protagonist, Harrison Bergeron, is a big, strong guy. And so he wears heavy, heavy weights. Anybody who's very strong has to be weighted down. Anyone who's very smart has to wear a headset that blasts interrupting sound effects, traffic noises, gunshots, whatever, every few seconds, depending on how smart you are, to keep you confused and distracted. And it is strictly enforced by a wonderful fiction name. I think her name was Diana Moon Glampers. Mm-hmm. That's a Kurt Vonnegut name, if ever I heard
one.
There
you go.
And I won't tell you how it ends, but it doesn't end well. And it ends on a poignant note, because the bad thing that happens, the parents of Harrison Bergeron watched it all unfold on television. And because of their natural disability or their enforced disability, a few minutes after it happens, they can't remember what happened.
And do you know where this was first published? Want to take a guess? It is Kurt Vonnegut, and the name of the short story is Harrison Bergeron. It was made into a movie called 2081.
Yeah. It was in a textbook, I swear, when I was in 7th or 8th grade, so it must have been before that.
And he republished it in the Welcome to the Monkey House collection.
Yeah.
But where was it originally published?
Well, it's a, you know, it is libertarian porn. So it could have been Boy's Life.
Mm-hmm.
Except I think there's a little too much, you know, naughty business going on there. Reader's Digest, something like that.
Go ahead.
Or Playboy.
No, this was published October 1961 in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction.
Yeah, which is still going strong, actually.
See? So there you go. Yeah.
I have a medium-sized pile of rejection letters proving
that they still exist.
They still exist, and they're still going just fine. They're still doing just fine. Yeah.
Dog Feast Herman says, yes, I know some libertarians who love this story because they see it as political correctness gone mad. I think it's about how the ruling class will use seemingly altruistic policies for their own means. Like how Reagan gave amnesty to illegal immigrants, it sounds compassionate at first until you realize he wanted to weaken unions and drive down labor costs. And also he wanted to help his farmer friends in California.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on this? That's exactly right. It's benevolent equality, but it actually crushes people's specific talents.
The core question of science fiction is what if, and the core plot, which is actually also the name of the story, is if this goes on, You take mm-hmm. one thing and you run it all the way out to its most logically absurd conclusion, and you see what's there, and then you write about it. That's sort of one way to write science fiction. And this is a cautionary tale, but it's not a cautionary tale about how we shouldn't help people.
Right.
Or lift them up from where they are, or try to make opportunities equal, or find a place for everyone in society. It is a story of a totalitarian regime that enforces its weird views by killing people,
mm-hmm.
By forcing them to wear costumes and forcing them to wear headphones and forcing them to have ultrasound. Oh, no, those are putting big things in their vaginas. No, I'm sorry. That's Republicans today.
That's different. All right. Number five. What else?
People that are in dangerous and high-stress jobs need to be rotated out for R&R. In order to do that, we need a formal training program.
We can talk about a training program later, but right now we need to focus on maintaining the workforce that we have, and this is going to have to be an area where the union gives ground.
The union?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were engaged in collective bargaining on behalf of the Colonial Workers Alliance. If that's not the case, then...
Madam President... That union died on New Caprica.
Chief, the workers in this fleet, they need someone to represent them in their interests. And if this society is becoming truly polarized between an entrenched political class and a disenfranchised underclass, we are doomed.
Yeah. It still amazes me that this crappy show from the 80s was turned into the best show of the 90s and the mm-hmm. 2000s. Mm-hmm. Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, this is a good one. This is a good episode.
Yeah, it with a show with many, many good episodes, this was an outstanding one about a caste system, a slave system. You're on the run from your enemy, and you're living under essentially a military dictatorship or military control. There's a civilian government, but you're running. You're constantly on the run from an enemy that's coming to get you. So you don't have time to settle down and make rules and enforce civilization. You have to do whatever you need to do to survive. Now, what that means is, by virtue of chance, if you are on the mining ship, you become a miner. Mm-hmm. And if you're on the agriculture ship, you become a farmer. And those skills are starting to be passed down to people's children. And it's becoming less of a military emergency and more of a society where you are going to be born into a particular class, and that class is where you will remain because that's what's necessary. And the question is, when do you sacrifice military necessity and efficiency for humanity?
Yeah, when do you sacrifice military discipline and order and start to celebrate, again, people's talents and proclivities? And when does that become more important than survival in a disciplined way? Yeah. Yeah.
Battlestar Galactica was really good about putting you in the middle of hard questions. Mm-hmm. It's not like, okay, here we are on this very fairly civilized planet, and there's plenty to eat and drink, and there's a lot of open space for everyone. And what shall we let people explore their potentials? No, we're going to put them in the middle of a war where someone has to keep doing A, B, and C, and doing it well, and doing it efficiently, and doing it every day, or else we're all going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens? What happens then? And it's a good question. And science fiction is really good at raising good questions.
Thank you, Dogfaced Herman, so much. We so appreciate you.
We do.
There are a lot of science fiction books coming out this year, Drift Class, and I came across an article that had books that the editors of one publication were most looking forward to, and I went through and pulled some out and ordered a couple, but. I wanted to kind of suggest these to people. If anyone wants to write to me and say, yeah, I'm going to read that too, and maybe we get on Goodreads together and talk about them. The first one I have just started, and it's by one of my favorite authors, Margaret Atwood. She has a new book out called The Heart Goes Last. It is about a couple who have faced the market crash of 2008 and are... jobless and homeless and living in their cars in the not too distant future. They wind up developing in the society a system whereby you go to prison for 6 months and then you have a home for 6 months. And it's a lovely home. And it is clearly to keep the prison industrial complex profitable that they make this trade-off of people that are so desperate for a roof over their head that prison is better than where they're living. And I just started it. It's a little bit I'm having a little trouble suspending my disbelief because the woman in the story, you'll find out in the first chapter, is a gerontologist. She's has lots of nursing home experience, and I keep thinking there's no way she'd be without a job for 6 months with nursing home experience. But you suspend your disbelief about that, and she's a very good writer, and it'll be interesting to see how this book goes. Second book is called The Lost Time Accidents. This one isn't out yet. It's by John Ray, W-R-A-Y. And in it, a character named Waldemar Waldy Tolliver, which is great. That's a very Dickensian name, isn't it? Waldy Tolliver wakes one morning to discover he has been exiled from the flow of time. The world continues to turn, and Waldy is desperate to find his way back, a journey that forces him to reckon not only with the betrayal at the heart of his doomed romance, but also the legacy of his great-grandfather's fatal pursuit of the hidden nature of time itself.
Oh, no.
Kind of an adventure. Reminds me a lot of a book I read last year, The 13 Lives of Harry August, which I really enjoyed. So I'm looking forward to that one. Another one I'm looking forward to is called Black Ass, a Novel. It's by A. Igoni Barrett, B-A-R-R-E-T-T. It's about a man who lives in Lagos, Nigeria. And he wakes up one morning and he is white, except for his black ass. And apparently it's very, it's not a very long book, but it's quirky and very well written and goes into some very deep issues. And I'm really looking forward to reading it. It's gotten fantastic reviews. It's already been released in Nigeria to rave reviews. And it is kind of a riff on Metamorphosis as well. There's a lot of Kafka references in it. So that looks very cool. I am really looking forward to Justin Cronin's third book in the Passage trilogy called The City of Mirrors. We've all been waiting for that one for a long time. Excuse me. The City of Mirrors, it's called, and that comes out in May.
And I need to be ready for the blowback in the house from that book.
Everybody leave mom alone.
Yeah.
It'll only take me a couple days to get through it.
But it's, you deeply commit to the books you read.
I do. If I'm really into a book, everybody has to go away.
Everybody knows about it. Sit,
read with me. Yeah. Yeah. And I do. I get emotional when and Justin Cronin is a very, you're surprised in a zombie book to get sentimental and to see things that are sentimental. And this is, he has a capability of making one feel deeply touched about his characters. So yes, all of a sudden he'll turn around everybody and see Blue Gal crying over her book.
There are no small zombie books, only small writers.
See? And speaking of zombie writers, Robert Chaz Shute, who is a listener to this show.
Hey, Robert.
Great indie writer. And I read the first book of his zombie series, The Plague of Days, which was very good. And the other two in that trilogy are on my list. This Plague of Days, yes. And he has a new series that's now complete called the Robot Planet series that you can get on Amazon. It's a series of books. And he's just a good writer. I really enjoyed that episode one. They called them episodes, not volumes, which is telling. Episode one, This Plague of Days, is a really good book. I really enjoyed reading that, and I'm looking forward to reading the Robot Planet series. So Robert Chaz, C-H-A-Z-Z, Shute, C-H-U-T-E, and he's on Facebook, and he's, you can just go look him up, and he's an indie writer, so he's a lot more accessible.
He's very busy.
I'm sure he's very busy. He churns out the books. But he's a little more accessible than Justin Cronin, let's put it that way. And he's accessible as a writer, not accessible books. I mean, his books are very good.
We were wondering the other day, and we're not going to look this up because it's more fun to speculate, what happened to all the Jay McInerney, the 80s.
Yeah,
writers.
We were talking about that. What happened to all those writers who did the coke books, the cocaine books, right?
We assume that they're all middle-aged professors tormenting the crap out of people at the Iowa Writers' Workshop.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Or they're Charlie Sheen.
Yeah.
Now, they've gone that route. I don't know.
We don't know, and we don't really
care. We're not going to look it up.
It's not a matter of, I wonder what... No, it's more a matter of what happens when that's your thing and then that thing's over. And uh-huh. that was a period of time when I was really... I had one foot in that world.
Yeah, you did. You did, yeah.
And
wasn't the cocaine foot either.
No. It was the you know, maybe I should... And I looked, and it was in a sense, it was like a priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
It was,
mm-hmm.
You have to live this life. You have to be a tenured professor. You have to write. You have to be the workshop guy. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to read every book by every one of your peers and comment on it and think about it.
You kind of have to live in Manhattan, too.
Yeah.
I mean,
pretty much.
It's the media world all over again.
But you really have to immerse yourself. It's not sufficient to write a book and submit it for publication. You have to be a part of the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
Taken
mm-hmm.
seriously, and to be and have any chance at all of being a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just way too much of a commitment. You know, I'm already married. I already have a job, and yeah. This doesn't look like a profession in any sense of the word. I understand this is an avocation. This is a priesthood. This is something that you have to pursue to the exclusion of everything else. At least it appeared that way to me from the outside, given all the research I was doing at the time. So
you were married, but not to me at that time.
Yes, I was.
That's what you're talking about. Yeah.
Married, but not to you. And it seemed an immensely egotistical thing to do, to take a giant flyer on a profession where so few people succeed. And if you want to succeed, you'd better lock yourself into a situation where someone is paying your salary.
Yeah, well, but there were a lot of, and I was in some of them, writers' workshops that were at adult education schools.
Oh, yeah.
Or bookstores or whatever, where there were a lot of attorneys.
Uh-huh. Who all thought
they could be John Gresham, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
I'll try this book thing. That'll be my ticket to being a millionaire. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So, times have changed for the better, I think, in that regard. So.
They have. And the marketplace has changed.
Yeah,
like, the
maybe for the better, maybe not. Hey, thank you, everybody, and thank you, Driftglass. I love you.
I love you, too. Thanks, everyone.
Have a great week, everybody. Bye.
We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.